The Alter Rebbe once blessed his famous chassid, Reb Isaac Hameler, one of his greatest pupils, with a blessing for Arichas Yamim, for long days. I have to give an introduction. These two realities in the Alter Rebbe's literature are defined as Das Tachten and Das Elyon. Das Tachten is the lower perception, and Das Elyon is the higher perception. In the lower perception, we exist. In the higher perception, we are nothing. We're absorbed in Hashem's all-pervading reality. So the Alter Rebbe once blessed Rabbi Isaac Hameler with long life, Arichas Yamim. So Rabbi Isaac Hameler said, yes, Abba Sizal Zayin B'deya Tzlula. I should live long with a clear mind. In other words, what he's simply saying is, I don't want to be a 95-year-old senile man. That's what he asked for. It should be B'deya Tzlula. Deya is a mind. Tzlula means clear. Or really, Tzlula means transparent. Translucent. So the Alter Rebbe said, yeah, B'deya Tzlula. The Vesvas meant B'deya Tzlula. As Das Elyon is not einscheinen in Das Tachten. Deya Tzlula means a transparent mind. Das Tachten shouldn't conceal Das Elyon. Das Tachten should be an open receptacle, should be translucent, transparent, through where Das Elyon can permeate. That's what Deya Tzlula means. There's a fascinating explanation in Chassidus to the Gemara in Brachas. I brought it here. The Gemara in Brachas, Daf Chav Dalet Amid Beis, discusses saying Shema in filthy pathways. In pathways that are filled with human fertilizer. Saying Shema. So Rabbi Huna said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan that if a person was walking in filthy pathways, he should place his hand on his mouth and he should say Shema. He's just separating the words that come from his mouth, the sacred words of Shema, from the physical repulsive environment around him. But he could say Shema. By the name of God, im amrali Rabbi Yochanan bepume loy tzaisen alei. If Rabbi Yochanan would have told me this halacha with his own mouth, I wouldn't listen to him. If Rabbi Yochanan himself would come tell me that he could say Shema in filthy pathways, I wouldn't listen to him. So there's a major argument between Rabbi Huna and Rabbi Chisda. What you do, Rabbi Chisda says, by no means can you say Shema in a filthy pathway. And the Gemara discusses it at length, and the Gemara brings a proof to Rabbi Huna and a proof to Rabbi Chisda. And the halacha, as we know in Shulchan Aruch and Siman Pei Hei, is like Rabbi Chisda, that you're not allowed to say it. And if you have been saying it and you came to a filthy pathway, you have to interrupt Shema and wait till you leave and continue saying it. Unless if there was a long relapse of time, you have to say it over again, which is discussed in the halach. Then the Gemara asks, what happens if you don't interrupt yourself? And the Gemara says it's a very negative thing for somebody who says Shema within filthy pathways. Then the Gemara says, what happens in pasak maschara? What's the reward of somebody who came to a filthy pathway and stopped saying Shema? What's his reward? So Rabbi Avohu said, on him the pasuk says, Ubadavar hazeh tarichu yamim. Through this thing, you will have arichis yamim. You will experience a long life. Rashi says, Bedavar hazeh bishvil dibur zeh. Because of this word, this thing, he interprets, because of this word that you were cautious about, this sacred Shema, you were sensitive to Shema, because of it, you will get long life. So Chassidus asks the question, what's the reward for somebody who didn't say Shema in a filthy pathway? And the reward is he has long life. I mean, what's so unique about this individual? So it seems like he did an extraordinary act. The Rebbe once discussed this Gemara at a Simchas Torah, a Fabrengen, it was Tavshin Chav Beis, 1961. He says, in this Gemara is projected some of the most profound elements of Chassidus. What are you saying in Shema? Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Hear, O Israel, Hashem is our God, Hashem is one. And how does Chassidus explain what Hashem Echad means? We know how Chassidus explains it, what Alter Rebbe explained in Tanya. The entire world is nothing but Hashem's energy. And as he put it in chapter 20 and 21, and that energy is absorbed within the intimate reality of Hashem and has no presence. So the only reality is Hashem's intimate essence. Or as Alter Rebbe puts it in this chapter, using a different model, which applies to different perception. This is already on a even on a lower level. The definition of every existence is the divine energy that creates it, or in other words, Hashem thinking it, that is its definition. And therefore, the only true existing reality is Hashem's infinity. In the place of infinity, nothing else can occupy any space. And that's what you're saying in Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. So now I'm in a filthy pathway, and I'm in the middle of saying Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, which means there is nothing outside the infinite, all-pervading reality of Hashem. Thus, filthy pathway. Where is there a pathway? Where is there filth? It's your problem. You placed yourself within a wall that's blocking your vision. Put on real lenses, real glasses, and you'll see there's no filth, there's no pathway, there's no you. The Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. You smell something, it's a horrible aroma. Who is the you that has an aroma? Zakhtar Pchizda Halikim. He doesn't just say, I'm not going to do it, Halikim. In the name of God, Rabbi Yechin himself would say it, I wouldn't listen to. You see the words Reb Chisda and Reb Huna employing in this argument that it's touching deep stuff, so to speak. It's a sensitive issue they're dealing with. Halakim is the attribute of Tzimtzum, very well, versus Yudke Vavke. Halakim, I wouldn't listen to Reb Huna said, like he could say Shema. Just put a mouth on your put a hand on your mouth. But Reb Chisda disagrees and Halacha disagrees. This became the halach. And not only the Gemara says there's a special reward for it. And the reward is Arichis Yamim. Because a person who's saying Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad and comes to a filthy pathway and stops, what is he saying? He is combining and integrating this paradox in his life. I'm in the middle of saying Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. And I know Hashem Echad. And nonetheless, I acknowledge that even though Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, there is a reality of a filthy pathway, and therefore I cannot say Shema here. You said Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. This paradox was inherent to the Alter Rebbe. We are something and nothing simultaneous. Because as a result of the Tzimtzum, our perception of the filthy pathway has a truth. It's not just an illusion that's to be disregarded. It has a truth. It has a truth in ultimate reality. It's not just the kid is an immature baby and therefore he thinks that his father became a one-year-old and just become more mature and forget about it. It's not true. No, it has a real truth. That's where the metaphor and the nimshal of the father don't apply.
So really, what happens to that filthy pathway in the oneness of God? The ultimate reality. If you say it has a truth in the ultimate reality, what happens?
In the ultimate reality is it's infinite. There's no pathway and there's no filth. What do I mean there's no pathway and there's no filth? The filthy pathway bespeak the infinity of Hashem. When you look at it, you don't see a pathway that's filthy. You see infinity of Hashem expressed itself through this physical expression. And this is essential to halacha. And therefore, what's the reward? Arichas yamim. The integration of a pre-symptom and a post-symptom reality allows a person to introduce infinity to his limited days. You're asking what happens if a blind man goes through a filthy pathway? But if he has usually blind people have a great sense of smell. So I think the sense of smell will do it.
To me, it's amazing because we learn in Shari Yitzhak that everything ultimately boils down to oneness. It's Simpson that created...
The whole halacha is based on this. You say, for example, through a mitzvah, you bring holiness into an object that was unholy. When you create tefillin, you create a holy object out of something that's unholy. That's essential to halacha. Halacha is divine wisdom. In other words, it was unholy before. Because as a result of the tzimtzum, the concealment has a reality. Nonetheless, on another level, the world is only the all-pervading reality of Hashem. And the Jew's consciousness fluctuates between Das Alyan and Das Tachten.
Where's the moon up there? Is that where the chibur that would connect Das Alyan
and Das Tachten? And the synthesis of the two is the process of history. The process of history. Just conclude here. With a vart and a story. This is how Chassidus explains one of the very enigmatic stories of this week's Parsha of Shlach, where the 10 scouts that Moshe Rabbeinu sends to spy and scrutinize Israel come back and dissuade the entire nation from going into the land by saying that we have seen in the land giants of giants and we are simply incapable of going in and conquering the country. We will be defeated, we will be decimated. Eretz Eicheles Yeshvei, it's a land that consumes its inhabitants. They will destroy us, they will annihilate us. They are mighty, we have no hope. And the entire nation falls into despair and they refuse to continue on their journey. What are we doing here in the desert? To Israel we can't come. We should have remained in Egypt. There are enough graves to bury us there. And we all know that the only two who opposed them were Yehoshua and Kalev, who said, Kalev said, Im chafetz bonu Hashem, if Hashem wants us, Alei Naila, we will ascend and we will inherit it. Successfully, lachmenuim al tirom, they are our bread, we can consume them, no need to fear, and so forth. And the Gemara in Saita explains that the spies use the term in the parasha, ki chazak humimenu, the mighty giants, the mighty warriors of the land of Canaan, are more powerful mimenu than he or than us. So you can interpret it more powerful than us. But the Gemara says more powerful than he. They're more powerful than Hashem. Afilu bal habayis eina yachal lahitzi kelev misham. The Gemara says, they said, even the master created vessels. He created a monster that he cannot deal with. He cannot get rid of. It's his vessels, but he cannot get rid of them. He cannot take them out of the house. He put them there, and it's beyond his control. And everybody asks the major questions, what happened here? First of all, you were dealing with tzaddikim, with righteous individuals who certainly believed in Hashem. What happened? The whole purpose of the Exodus of Egypt was to come into Eretz Yisrael. How did they make such an error that caused such a tragedy that all of the entire generation died in the desert and nobody went into Eretz Yisrael, including Moshe Rabbeinu, for other reasons. But what's even more perturbing is, how can the scouts present such an idea and the Jews should accept it? Right then, on the spot, they were living a daily supernatural life. If you would come to Jews today and you would say, Acharai, after me, we're going to conquer this and this country. Naturally, it's impossible, I understand. You can easily dissuade a nation of doing it. But they were living a supernatural life daily. You'll ask them, what do you have for breakfast today? What do you have for dinner last night? What would they tell you? We didn't go to the pizza shop across the street. Food came from heaven. What do you have for a drink? What do you have for a l'chaim last night? A moving well of Miriam that was created supernaturally. What is protecting you in this fearful, awesome journey in the desert? Clouds, supernatural clouds, and a fire at night and a cloud by day. What is smoothing the mountains, killing the snakes and the scorpions? Supernatural clouds. So their daily existence and the most necessary issues were dependent upon miracles. You'll ask them, how did you guys get out of Egypt? You just walked out of Egypt. Egypt was a world power, was the superpower. How did you do it? Miraculously, what happened? 10 plagues killed out the hierarchy of the nation. They came to pursue you by the Red Sea. How did you get rid of them? You killed them naturally? No. A sea split and they were drowned. In your song that you sang right afterwards, you said, all the inhabitants of Canaan, when they heard about this, their hearts melted. When Yeshua sent 2 spies later, 40 years later, the 2 spies heard the people in Canaan still talking about the news what happened 40 years ago. So how can the spies come to the Jews and say, this is a land that will consume us, will destroy us? God can deal with them. These very people, 1 year ago, have witnessed a superpower crumbling before their eyes through clear, divine, supernatural intervention that could have no natural scientific interpretation. I shared with you that it's the only miracle in Jewish history that nobody can give, or nobody, the Jewish people at least, there was nobody that can give it scientific, political, economic, historical, rational perspective. Purim was good connections in the White House, great connections. Hanukkah was a great Israeli Air Force, skillful fighters. You can always detach it from Hashem. But the Exodus of Egypt was very difficult to do. I mean, I did see in the Israeli newspapers a while ago, a scientist explaining all of the 10 plagues scientifically. I'd say this is a Jewish genius. So his open-mindedness was so brilliant that his brains fell out. It was just extraordinary. All the 10 plagues scientifically.
It was a successful explanation.
It was interesting. He says they happened, but it was scientific. It was not supernatural.
Moshe knew, but ahead of time, that was also natural.
So, Chassidus explains it based on the concept we're discussing here. The Meraglim did not want to go into the land of Israel because they knew that the system is going to change drastically. And I'm going to put it in the context of this chapter of Tanya. In the desert, the definition of existence was godliness and spirituality. They knew that. They lived in a physical world but in a very spiritual way. Their entire physical sustenance came directly from Hashem, and their entire occupation was learning Torah and being absorbed in the oneness of Hashem. They knew when you come into the land of Israel, suddenly a percentage of the population will have to become experts on agriculture. Another percentage of the population will have to become farmers. Another percentage will have to become professors in economy, merchants, salesmen. Another percentage of the population will have to become military men, politicians. They knew that. 6 years you will have to prune and sow your fields. They knew politics, the army, economy, agriculture can all be very spiritual and divine, but they all breed corruption. They knew that Jews are an extraordinary people, but when it comes to running a country, it's bad news. Of course, when you run a country, you have to have lawyers, which some people use as another name for thieves. Whatever it is, they knew it can only create problems. And therefore, they didn't want to go in. Not because they were unholy, because they were very holy. They didn't want to detach themselves from the oneness of Hashem. When you're plowing your earth, or you're fighting a war, or you're creating a constitution, or you're selling your product, it's very hard to be absorbed in the oneness of Hashem. It threatens that attachment. Eretz Echelos Yishvei. It's a land, the physicality of it will consume us like food. It will reduce us to its food. It will redefine our identities from spiritual, transcendental human beings to earthly, materialistic, self-oriented people. This is what they meant. Ki chazak hu mimenu. They are stronger than Hashem. The spies didn't know that Hashem controls the world. The Jews didn't know that Hashem controls the world. They didn't know that Hashem can descend, can bring down manna. If He wishes, the entire Israel can become theirs in an infinitesimal of a moment. Of course they knew it. But their logic went as follows. Within an environment that is supernatural, or in a process that's supernatural, of course Hashem will exhibit His supernatural identity. But the whole purpose of coming into the land is where Hashem says, okay, gentlemen, okay, children, now life assumes a natural identity. So afilu balabayis eina yachal ahitzi kelov. The master cannot take out the vessels that he created because he desired to put you into a situation where natural circumstances have power. In the desert, you're dealing in a divine sanctuary. So divinity is exhibited. When you come to the land of Israel, what does Hashem say? You have to plow the earth to produce vegetation. Why? Because there are laws of nature. And you have to follow the laws of nature. Ah, if we're surrendering to the laws of nature, take it all the way. Let's put it in this context. If you're telling me we're going to live in a pre-Tzimtzum world, Gesunte 8. 31 kings, 100 kings, 1 million kings. It's all the oneness of Hashem. There's any other identity? Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. There's no filth and there's no pathways. But the Meraglim says, one second. The whole purpose of coming into the land is you're taking me to a post-Tzimtzum reality. You're telling me there are rules. There is a world. That's the whole point of coming into the land. You have to settle it, and you have to sow it, and you have to create an army, and you have to create a government. Why? Because there are laws of nature. There is a world that has laws, that has its own consciousness, and you have to consider that consciousness. It validates it. So what are you confusing me, the pre-Tzimtzum world and the post-Tzimtzum world? Either you embrace this world or you embrace this world. But if you embrace the post-Tzimtzum world, take it all the way. And if you take it all the way, we have no hope. If you are surrendering to nature, because nature has a power, we have no hope. This is a sophisticated argument. If you want to talk religion, but if you want to talk state, if you want to talk about God, gesunte eight. But if you want to talk about the world and you want to embrace the world, you have to consider the rules of the world. And the rules of the world is that 31 mighty emperor kings will conquer a nation, a frail nation. The past is past, but reality is reality. But needless to say, as one Jew once said, we Jews don't believe in miracles, we just count on them. Jews don't believe in the miracles. God forbid to believe in them. Chassidus says the spies made an error on two counts. The fact that they wanted to stay in the desert was wrong, because they missed the point. The point, purpose of the entire creation, as Dr. Rebbe said in chapter 36, was to make this world a godly place, the physical world a godly place, through engaging nature and not rejecting it, through engaging our animal soul in the world and not overwhelming it, making this world an abode for Hashem's unity that transcends creation. That's the purpose. So what do you mean you want to stay in the desert because you want to be absorbed in the oneness of Hashem? It's a beautiful desire, but it warrants contrary to the whole purpose for which you were created, for which the world was created. And thus, they were also wrong on the second count. And this is what Kalev says, Im chafetz banu Hashem. Since Hashem desires us, and Hashem wanted that this world should become His abode, so with that power, the supernatural miracles of godliness can permeate the environment where we consider and we validate and we acknowledge nature. Or in other words, the pre-Tzimtzum universe doesn't only exist in seventh heaven. It exists in the real world. And ultimately the two ought to become one. And ultimately the two will become one.
The two are one.
We don't see it. The two are one. And they will become one in our own consciousness. In a revealed way. That's what I mean. Okay, now we'll take the summer break.
First the Meyer.
First the Ma'ariv break, then a summer break. But as...
you know we're going to come back here? Then.
Yeah, I'll tell you in a moment. It's just... the Rebbe once concluded a long Fabring and a long Hasidic gathering. When he was about to leave, he says, it's the Machen Hafsak, and now we'll take a break. We'll interrupt. But he said once, the Rebbe Maharash, whom I mentioned in the beginning of the class, had a daughter. Her name was Dvorah Leah. When she was a little girl, she wanted something, and they didn't give it to her. So what did she do? She, what little children like to do, she threw a tantrum. But she knew how to screech. And you know, when your children know how to screech, they can drive you up a wall. So she went for half an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, screaming on the top of her lungs, driving the entire household berserk, mad. Finally, she got tired. The Rebbe told the story. She was 8 years old. She got tired. To stop now would be acknowledging defeat. Not to stop. She was exhausted. So she stopped crying. But before that, she made an announcement. She says, I'm not stopping to cry. I'm just taking a little break so I should be able to continue the crying later on. I'm not stopping. So the break is an integral component of the weeping. That's what she said. An eight-year-old girl's wisdom. She was the daughter of the Rebbe Marash. She was gassed in Treblinka, 1942. Yeah. Dori Aleya, together with her. I'm sorry, the daughter of the Rebbe Marash that was gassed, her name was Chaya Mushka. I'm not sure if this story occurred with Chaya Mushka to her later, but one of his daughters was killed. Yeah, she was an old lady, but not that so old. Rebbe Marash passed away in 1882. As a very young man, he was 49, so she was a little girl. She wasn't so old. So the purpose of our break is, first of all, the technical purpose, I'm going away. The spiritual purpose is that we should be able to internalize the first 48 chapters on our own. It's like the metaphor the Baal Shem Tov once gave. You know the metaphor? We'll finish with this. The metaphor the Baal Shem Tov once gave with the fox. Baal Shem Tov said a story. Once the lion got very, very angry at all of the animals in the forest. And since the lion is the king of the forest, so when the lion is mad, it's extremely dangerous. So all of the lions made an emergency conference to discuss what we do to assuage, to appease the lion and remove the wrath. So everybody came together. Reb Wolf and Reb Ber and Reb Hirsch, Reb Doiv, Reb Tzvi, Reb Zev. And who else do we have?
Adler.
To discuss the mood of Reb Leib. What do we do? The animals were deeply perturbed and really frightened for their life. Because if Reb Leib is not in a good mood, that could mean their end, their extinction. Nobody has what to say until Rabbi Fuchs appeared. The shul, the fox, he said, he in his wit and his wisdom, he says, I have 300 humorous anecdotes and deep stories through which I can transform Reb Leib's mood. I will just begin talking and he will be so captivated. I will trap him in. I will lure him in into my charisma and into my wisdom. That will be the end of his bad mood. Great idea. The animals begin their march to the cage of Reb Leib. And Rabbi Fuchs is leading the march. After a few miles, he begins scratching his forehead. He turns to Reb Wolf on his side. He says, you wouldn't believe it. I forgot 100 stories. Reb Wolf says, your 200 stories are good enough for the blape. So they continue the march. A few miles pass. He turns to Reb Hunt and he says, you wouldn't believe it. I forgot another 100 stories. So the dog tells him, your 100 stories of you suffice. They continue the journey. They're about to enter the cage. And this time the fox almost faints. He turns around. He says, my dear brothers, I forgot the last 100 stories. Ich weiß gar nicht. I know nothing. This was bad news because the lion already observed them approaching him. And he was burning with wrath and anger. And now they have to go in, but they have nothing through which to appease him. and no animals can do anything, and the fox forgot everything. It was literally a crisis, an emergency. What do? And the fox turns to them and he says, what we all have left is not my stories and not my wisdom, but our own individual voices. So what we have to do now is each animal has to go in on his own and cry to Reb Leib in his own voice or her own voice, requesting from him to grant them life, to grant him or her life. He says that's what the moment calls for. I cannot encompass you. You all have to do it on your own. So the Baal Shem Tov said that very often in life we enjoy the inspiration or the wisdom we receive from teachers, from mentors, from leaders. He says, go into a shul Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. The shuls appoint for themselves a fox, which we call a chazan, and he cries, he sings, he feels, he experiences. Zog de Baal Shem Tov, the fox can bring you till the cage. The fox serves a purpose, to elevate you initially from your own domain to the cage of the king. That the fox serves a great purpose for that. He schleps you all the way. But he says to enter into the domain of the king, he's not going to do it for you. You have to do it on your own. Everybody has their own voice, the Baal Shem Tov says, and you with your own voice and your own individual personality have to discover your own relationship with the king. So have a good night and a wonderful week, and a freilich in zummer. A happy summer. The classes on Tanya will resume after the holidays. The first Sunday, which is the 27th day of Tishrei, Sunday Parshas Noach. And usually Heichal Menachem hangs up signs in the streets of Borough Park on Flatbush on the poles. If you forget the date, and or you can call the office again if you forget the date, just to confirm it. That's the main thing. Halavai, the classes should continue in your shalim, then we'll hear the Alter Rebbe giving. We'll have a Meirv. And when we resume, we have 5 chapters left. Mem Tes, Nun, and Aleph, Nun, Beis, Nun, Gimel. I hope by the Alter Rebbe's yard site we'll complete it. I hope, according to my strategy. Emirat Hashem. We'll decide. Maybe Gar Sachova. We'll see you around. Yeah. No. Yeah. No. Also ich schreibe da. Da muss da weiter schreibt. Du hast es gesehen, also schreibt. Ah. Von wem hast du es gehört? Ja, ich kenne. Der Amchal expert. Ja, I know. Abelze. Ja. Die Sachen sind nicht das. Bei Michilas Quede. Er will dann auch schöne Sachen. Er will mit Tavach sein, alle mit Kabbalen. Ich habe gerade besorgen, wenn letzte Woche. Ich habe gerade wegen dem Bariches. Aber auf das Lot ich gewollt machen, ist alle Sachen. Aber es ist nicht das. Die Sache.
Rambam himself, or he said that the Pshat in the Rambam was wrong?
The Maharal doesn't mention his name. He doesn't mention the Rambam's name. He says, Elu ha'imrim, those people who say this, and he quotes what the Rambam says. But he doesn't mention him by his name.
But so did the Maharal hold that's what the Rambam held? Did the Maharal hold that was what the...
He criticizes the opinion of the Rambam.
Oh, okay. Is that that... Did he say that somebody else was shot wrong in Rambam?
No, no. Okay. He quotes the words. The Rambam says the words. You can't... The Maharal and the Rambam.
But in general, the Chassidus reconciles
Kabbalah and philosophy and Chakira, yeah, which is difficult. Right. It's very difficult to do. He had to reveal a new depth to be able to show how they both fit in.
But I think that would go cut across guns.
No, generally Chakira, Kabbalah, and Halacha. Because Bechal, the Kabbalists and the philosophers never got along.
The old stories of fights in Spain. And
they never got along. Not in practicality, and certainly not ideologically. And even if practically they got along, not ideologically. You'll take a person like... They were all controversial, and the Mekabalim disagreed. Take a person like Der Albag, Taker, Reb Levi Ben Gershon. Der Albag lived in France. He passed away in the year Heikov Dalet. 1344, very early. His famous philosophical book is Milchamas Hashem, which means the war of Hashem. He fights the wars of Hashem.
Translated
into English. It's a very hard book. It's classical philosophy. He proves Hashem's existence and all these types of ideas. So one of the great Mekabalim, whose name was Reb Shem Tov, he authored a book on Kabbalah called Sefer HaEmunos. He says you have to retitle Ralbag's book and call it Milchamos Im Hashem. It's wars with Hashem, not for Hashem. I'm just giving you an example.
Well, what was it, one of the Rabbi Eichhaffer quotes certain philosophers as saying that the Christians have their three and the Kabbalists have their ten?
Yeah?
It's in the book Meditation of Kabbalah. He quotes certain halakhic authorities as saying.
But that's absurd.
Of course, it's absurd. They didn't understand the idea.
Which halakhic authorities?
I forget, but you know what? It's their Meditation of Kabbalah right in the beginning. You can easily see it. It was in Spain.
Yeah, Freilich Zimmer. Zeigesund, Freilich Zimmer. Welcome to you. Happy summer.
It just shows they didn't understand. Their world was halacha. They didn't understand that world of Kabbalah.
Yeah.
It was coming public. Yeah. It was newly coming public.
Yeah. I wanted to tell you, Benegaya the halacha, also what we spoke last week. Naturally, you could say, the reason you're not allowed to say Shema in a filthy pathway is because halacha applies to people's perception. So gesund. The truth is that there's no dirty alley. But the world of halacha applies to our perception of things. And in our perception, it's a dirty alley. But Chassidus doesn't want to say that. Because Chassidus says halacha is part of Torah. And Torah is truth. You understand? So when Talacha says you're not allowed to reach Shema on a dirty pathway, it's because Torah, which is Emes, acknowledges that it's a filthy pathway. You can't say, of course the Tzimtzum exists. Look at the world. All of Torah Mitzvahs is only because there's a world. But we have to explain what that means. That's not a proof yet. You could say, of course, from the world you can't prove it. It's your illusion. It's your problem. Or from the fact that people do, from the fact that people do evil. Or there are things that are forbidden to do.
But these things,
you say, why are these things forbidden?
Right, you could argue it's all oneness, so why should anything be forbidden?
A person could say, yeah, it's in your illusion. It's a Torah is talking to your illusion. Right. But Chassidus says, no, Torah is true. So the fact that Torah, which is truth, says that there are dirty, that there are filthy pathways, mm-hmm. or whatever else it says, means that there's a truth to it, to its reality.
And then how do you understand?
And that's also the reason why, for example, a tzaddik, a complete tzaddik, who walks through a filthy pathway, is not allowed to say Shema.
Doesn't have a different set of halachas.
If Moshe Rabbeinu would walk through it, he wouldn't have a different halacha. Right? Right. But as long as that reality exists, Moshe Rabbeinu is also not allowed to say Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem
Echad. Then how do you say
even though these are not only souls because even the highest souls,
yeah,
even the highest souls that are very sensitive to the oneness of Hashem were affected by the tzimtzum. Even in Atzilus, there's a tzimtzum. That's what the Alter Rebbe says in the footnotes. That's why it's Atzilus. Even the Alter Rebbe before, he talks about the infinite energy that has to be condensed. He says that infinite energy ain't by tzimtzum kol kach. Yeah, people ask, why do you say tzimtzum kol kach? There's no tzimtzum at all. Because here he's talking about the world of Atzilus, and in the world of Atzilus there is a tzimtzum. It's just ain't by tzimtzum kol kach, like in the world of Bria. Yeah, but there's a tzimtzum. And that tzimtzum already allows for an existence of kalim, as he put it in the footnote. And therefore, even Moshe Rabbeinu, when he put on tefillin, he accomplished something. And what he accomplished was, he brought in holiness into the hide of the animal. Even though in the pre-tzimtzum reality, the hide of the animal is infinite. You don't have to bring in holiness to it. But the hide of an animal as something outside of holiness is valid even in the world of Moshe Rabbeinu.
Okay, this is a little bit of a paradigm shift for me, but now you have to help me understand Shari Yichud Be'emunah, we just read about a week or two ago that if you were to see how something really looks, it would disappear into the oneness. Like,
yeah, but what does he continue? Like the ray of the sun
in the
source.
Right.
But then he continues.
Okay.
He asks a question.
Yeah.
The question is, the rays of the sun left the sun. And therefore we see the rays because they exist in a space where the sun doesn't exist. But the question is, we never left the source. So how do we feel ourselves?
That's why I conclude. That's what it feels like. There's an illusion.
Well, one said, no, that's not what it doesn't say it's an illusion.
Okay.
Dr. Rebbe asks you a question.
Okay.
Dr. Rebbe says, if our eyes would be sensitive, we would dissolve into oneness.
Right.
Like the rays of the sun in the sun.
Right.
The whole reason you experience rays is because they're outside of the sun. Sure. But if the rays of the sun are in the sun, you don't experience rays. Yeah, that's what he says. We're a ray, and we're in the sun, you don't experience a ray. So Dr. Rebbe asks a question, but it's not like the metaphor. Because in the metaphor, the rays really left the sun. And in our case, the rays never left the sun. So what's the difference if your eye is sensitive or not? There's no I as in I and I as in
right.
EYE, to experience that. That's his question in chapter 3, yeah? That's
you
how he finishes chapter 3 with a question.
Right, yeah.
Yeah?
Okay.
What is the answer? He doesn't say it's an illusion.
He said that it's really there. It's just
what does he say? He says in Perek Dal something else. He says there's Hagadol and there's Hagibur. Hashem is a Gadol and he's a Gibur. Hain Vuroisov. Hashem has an infinite power of projection and he has an infinite power of concealment. So how does he answer the question?
I'll tell you how it sounds to me.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not saying this is the truth, but this is the way it sounds to
yeah.
me. The way it sounds to me is, okay, God has... He has this great ability to hide his presence, even though he's really there, and even though he's the real reality.
To hide his presence and to allow the creatures to exist and experience their existence as though they're outside of the
right.
sun.
And we feel like we left
the sun.
And I made the jump from that to say, okay, so then we're an illusion. This feeling of that we're separate beings is a.
But this faculty of Hashem is not an illusion, it's a real faculty.
why, how does not being able to comprehend something translate into an illusion? Because it's
Not ultimate.
You can't comprehend it, but it's a paradox.
Don't say it's an illusion. Say it's a paradox. But why an illusion means it's not true? But the Rebbe doesn't say in chapter 3. Not only says it doesn't say it's true, he says Hagibur is as godly as Hagadol. It's a part of Hashem. The concealment is a divine attribute. Why is that untrue? You could say something else.
The concealment is a divine attribute. I see what you're saying.
Chassidus says something else.
Yeah.
The concealment only blurs the vision from our side. It's like the tinted windows of a car. When you're in the car, you see outside as though it's just a transparent piece of glass. That's what Chassidus says. That since the tzimtzum is a divine quality, it doesn't conceal divinity. It doesn't conceal Hashem's sight. That's true.
So how can it not?
Which is what he says here also. That's what he says in the Seviv Kalalman is only for us. He's here, no difference.
So what happened before creation? Before creation, there's just Hashem. And what about his powers of Gevura and all that?
He didn't choose to express them. He didn't even choose to express his light.
So you can't even ask that question because it was only one. Right. Yeah, but my question simply is still something that's not driving well for me, and I'm not quite sure what it is. It might not.
That's good. I'd be scared to say it jives.
It's good. If you read any discourse of the Alter Rebbe in Lakota Torah, you'll see a paradox. Almost every discourse. In the beginning of the discourse, he'll tell you that you have to realize almost every discourse in Lakota Torah.
Yeah.
Discourse after discourse, you'll see this paradox. He'll tell you. Our Jew has to reflect. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Our whole identity is nothing but spiritual, but the divine energy. The divine energy that creates us in the presence of its source is also nothing. It's also nothing. It constitutes no identity. And therefore, the entire world really constitutes nothingness in the presence of Hashem's intimate self. It doesn't express his identity. It's drowned. It's submerged. Not that it doesn't exist. It's kalechosh.
Right, it's like sunlight in the sun.
Yeah.
Okay, so
when you reflect upon this seriously, the Jew seeks to nullify himself totally, to get dissolved totally in the oneness of Hashem.
Okay. It's all that I understand so far.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right?
I mean, all that I've read many times, I understand that. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean,
do you experience it?
Do I experience it? Yeah. There are moments I feel closeness. I feel like there's something beyond me.
But you realize that you never experience it.
No, if I experience it, I disappear.
There would be nobody to experience it.
Right.
That's the problem of Olam HaBriya. Olam HaBriya knows everything. The problem is that it knows it. In Atzilus, there's not nobody to know anything.
But why does one seek to prove to themselves what it is? There's many factors within ourselves, the heart is beating. You're not aware of it that it's beating. It's making all kinds of noise. You're not supposed to know that it's working. It will bother you with all kinds of things happening inside you. It's the same thing with Hashem. Happening inside you now.
Yeah, that's
You're not aware of it. I'm saying your heart is beating. There's blood.
If you would be aware of it,
it would be problems.
You want to know why I'm obsessed with it? Is that your question?
I guess. I'm saying
you want to understand my
distraction, right? It's a distraction.
You want to say the Maestro with the professor.
You want to know my obsession with it? I'll tell you my obsession with it. Not a problem. It has to do with the because I was told in the Torah I'm supposed to have a relationship with Hashem. So
one second, but that's only one half of Chassidus. There's a second half to Chassidus.
Yeah.
Somebody, a writer once, who wrote extensively on Chassidus, put it well.
Yeah.
he says that the Alter Rebbe was Bepchinas Kala. He says in Shir HaShirim, the Alter Rebbe, why is the whole Shir HaShirim called Kala? Because the Alter Rebbe says the whole world is God's bride, Kala. What's Pshat Kala? There's two interpretations to Kala. First interpretation in Kala is a yearning. Not Klesa Nefesh. Samalecha Nafshi. What's the word he used? No, not Kama. A desire, a yearning, a craving. There's a word. Kol San Nafshi Lechatzer is Beis Hashem. My heart pines, it yearns, it craves.
Okay.
Another taich in Kala is extinction. Vayechulu Hashemayim. Completion, it ends. Klois HaNefesh, Kiloyin HaNefesh, the soul expires, its journey is finished. It's not here anymore. It ends. Alter Rebbe says, one is Das Tacht and one is Das Alyan. When you experience Mamalik Al Almin, you're a Kala. You're Kol Sanaf Shalachatzah is Beis Hashem. When you experience that your essence is spiritual energy, you crave spirituality, but you don't expire, you're not dissolved. There is me. It's just, what is the true me? The true me is not a piece of flesh and blood. The true me is a spiritual divine me. But there is a me. Alter Rebbe says, Das Elyon, that we can feel. That everybody can feel. If you work on yourself hard, you can sensitize yourself to your soul. That everybody can feel. And to the divinity in your soul. The second Kala, Alter Rebbe says, that's Das Elyon. Das Elyon is not, there is me, but who is the me? The me is an expression of the divine me. When you experience true divine infinity, then there's no me. And he says that's the second Kala. And that's why in Shir HaShirim there's two brides paralleling these two experiences. So this guy writes, he says, with the Alter Rebbe's philosophy, there was a danger that he would swallow up the entire existence in the realm of Kala. The entire existence would be absorbed in the oneness of Hashem and then it will all dissolve. He says that was the danger present in the Alter Rebbe's writings. The Alter Rebbe and his philosophy tended to swallow up everything in the oneness of Hashem.
He says, that perspective influenced a lot of my life to this point.
What redeemed, he says, the world was one more attribute in Likutei Torah, which is discussed as much as Malchus, and as discussed as much as Kala, and that's Malchus. The Rebbe says, Malchus, Ein Melech B'Layam. A king needs a nation. The nation has to be separate from the king. Because of Malchus of Hashem, the Tzimtzum happened, and the world assumes its own identity. And he says, L'fichach, therefore, Zachse Chabad L'pchinas HaMalchus. Chabad merited to have the attribute of Malchus to it always, because Malchus is what redeemed it. Malchus is what redeemed the world.
Redeemed the people from being too oriented to being swallowed up.
To be totally dissolved. And that's what you'll see. Every discourse in Likutei Torah will always start with this and will always end. But Nisav, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yisrael Dira B'Tachtayinim.
So I always interpret that to mean he wanted the illusion.
He wanted the illusion.
No, that, I'm just trying to give you my.
If he wanted it, it's not an illusion. Of course, he wanted to say he wanted it. You don't have to say the illusion. He wanted this. He wanted we should perceive life this way. And it has value. It's not just.
So my question is, if it all started off in a state of nothingness, and it's all capable any second of returning to nothingness.
That's true.
Then the Malchus is something that's superimposed in a sense.
You'll be surprised to learn that nothingness is also superimposed.
Okay, so obviously I have a lot to learn.
You think nothingness does express it?
Yeah, I don't. Nothingness means that the Yesh Amiti, Hashem.
What did you say? What did you say? Somethingness is what?
this world, based on that, on theory of what the ultimate reality is, looks to me to be super.
The concept of nothingness was also created. You know that.
No.
Yeah.
Look, that was the natural state of all existences, oneness.
No, that's after the Tzimtzum. Nothingness implies somethingness. We appreciate nothingness only in the context of somethingness. What does nothing mean? It's not something.
It means it's the Yesh Amiti. That's the other side of that coin.
It's the shlila of everything.
So it's still valid.
It's valid, but in our world, the shlila of everything. You say, the world is nothing. Before the Tzimtzum, you couldn't say that. You couldn't say the world is nothing.
But there was no world.
It's easy to say. When we say there's no world, it makes sense to us because there was no world. You know a world. And you're saying there was no world. To be able to say that is only after the Tzimtzum. Before the Tzimtzum, you couldn't say there was no world. In other words, we already experience Hashem pervades everything, okay. Which means everything else is nothing. That's already a product of the Tzimtzum. You can relate to what I'm saying. What I'm saying is our experience of nothingness doesn't express the true nothingness that Chassidus discusses.
Mm-hmm. So what is the true nothingness?
It's not like that's also what I'm saying. That's also not...
also a post-Simpson reality?
Yeah.
So before, when the Orei Tzai, or even...
Darizal says, Lehaya makim la'midas ha'ilam, there was no room for the world. What does he mean there was no room? He doesn't mean only in space. Like I said, with this table is, you can't put another table. It doesn't only mean that.
Nothing was tolerated.
You couldn't talk about the world being nothing.
Is it because you couldn't talk, period?
I don't only mean talk or think. Well, I mean in reality. The context of Hashem as a something and everything else as nothing, the Arizal says, is already a creation of Tzimtzum. The concept that Hashem is all pervading and there's nothing besides He is a concept of Tzimtzum. It's a good. I just want to bring out to you how we don't understand what pre-Tzimtzum means. Right, you see that. This whole Pedek is about Atzilus. Yeah? And he says it's Ein Sof, Ein Ketz, Ein Tachlis. It's all pervading. The whole Pesach is about Atzilus.
Our perspective.
And what does he say? It's all in our footnote. He says it's all post-Tzimtzum. Hu Amada. It's one with him and it's infinite and it's all post-Tzimtzum. So what's the difference? You see from here that pre-Tzimtzum is a different Indian.
What is it?
You have to be sensitive to it. It's important to be sensitive to it. There's no place for the existence of the world. It doesn't only mean because He's everywhere. That's already a post-Tzimtzum term. He's everywhere. You couldn't talk about Hashem as everything. These are all Tzimtzum. This is all a dictionary that Tzimtzum created. New words, you know, certain dictionaries create new words. One of the words is Hashem is everything. Hashem is all pervading. There is nothingness. One of the words is there. One of the words is. He. It's all Tzimtzum words. That's what he means. There's no place for the world, is like you'll say, this logic that you just said has no place. What does it mean it has no place? It doesn't fit in anywhere. Its reality doesn't begin. But it's even more than in the metaphor. I'm saying place doesn't only mean, like people say, where the world is, Hashem can't be. Where Hashem is, the world can't be. You can't say the word reality. You can't even say Hashem is reality. When we say Hashem is reality, we attribute already certain forms to reality. We know what reality is. I'm not telling you this table is not reality. Hashem is reality. But it's already similar.
So you can't even attribute existence in a sense.
Yeah.
But then that justifies
atheism. I don't know. Huh? Justifies atheism. Yana atheism. You want to call it atheism? Call it atheism.
No.
You want to hear something sharp? The Rebbe Rashab once said that the Apikursim sometimes have it more right than the Ma'aminim, because the God that the believers believe in, Taka, doesn't exist.
I remember your brother telling that.
The Rebbe Rashab said everything has a source in holiness. What's the source of atheism and godliness? So you know what he says? When they say he doesn't exist, they're right. They're right. What we call existence doesn't be. He doesn't exist that way. It's a starker word.
But you're saying that even
okay. It's a complete. It's a complete das takens. It's a shit.
Wow. So if that is the case, then let me understand. So what you're basically saying is that he does exist in reality, but he doesn't. But he doesn't exist in a way that we understand existence.
It's called Metziyas Bilti Metziyas Nimtza. Metziyas Bilti Metziyas Nimtza. Non-existential states of existence. Doesn't help us much.
No, it sounds like an oxymoron.
Thank you.
It's the truth.
Existence.
You know, existential means something of inherent existence.
The Tzimtzum already is a new Maisa. It's a whole new Maisa. That's what he says. You know, that's what I discussed. There's four shittas about it. It's a big argument. It's a big debate.
There's four shittas about the light, you're telling us.
And the male of the keli.
Oh, what role the keli plays.
Yeah, about that. It's vis-a-vis the light.
But
somebody looking at it like...
In the world of Kabbalah...
Of the keli
no, it's metaphoric.
No, still.
Not as a keli outside of it.
The world of Kabbalah discusses at the beginning of eight Adam Kadmon talks about or a Zach turning into or a gas, you know, and through that from the lights that come out of the mouth of Adam Kadmon.
We call it a Kaili. First have to give it a name. It's called a Kaili. It's not the Pasa. In our world, it's two things. You have the electricity and you have the wire. You have the message and you have the words.
You have a quarter.
Mm-hmm. It's talking two separate things. Here you're not talking about two separate things.
No, it's almost like, take a look at the example of the water and the cup, right? You put the cup in a faucet. So you reach, even if the water is overflowing the cup, right? So you have more of light. More air than the cave can handle. But it's still limited. That world is still limited to 8 ounces.
as far as the cup is concerned, it can be iris all over, but it doesn't relate to it. It relates to 8 ounces of it.
Right.
If you increase the kaili, there's a simultaneous effect.
Right.
So as long as you're not saying that there is that there is no water, as long as you're not saying that there's a shortage. As long as you're not saying that there's a deficit of water, so you mess with the kaili, everything messes with proportional. Which means, if you're looking at it, you're not saying that there's it's almost like you can't say that there's two methods. You can either add water or increase the kaili. That you can do when there's a potential that you don't have enough water. How does that relate? For us, it's two things. You could increase the kaili without increasing what gets in slavish, so you could have an empty kaili. But not in this context, it would seem.
Well, the Pardes gives an example, a famous one. He gives the example of water coming into colored vessels,
colored glasses,
red, green, yellow. He gives three colors, I think white, red.
I've seen it quoted.
Huh?
I've seen it quoted.
It says in Chassidus, he says these three colors because Chassid Gvura Teferis. Yeah.
Which
he uses the colors red, Gvura, and I guess white.
That's best,
and what's the third one?
Green
maybe
or yellow would be.
Yarek.
Right, but it covers.
Yarek is green or yellow.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Or not white. Blue. Blue is Chassid, no. and red and yellow, Yarek, which is yellow or green. Stefaris. And he says, to say that the water assumes a color is absurd. But if you're looking at the water through the glass, it's green.
That was my first introduction.
So Chassidus says, it's not an illusion. It's an illusion. The water became green. Chassidus says, if you'll take a picture of the water, it's green. In other words, the way the water impacts its observers, the water doesn't impact us. But if the water was to emit electrical energy, the way the water would impact its observers is in a green fashion. If the water would produce an energy coming through the vessel, the water assumes the properties of green.
That's what you mean by it's a reality. You mean the impact level.
On the impact, the water becomes green.
Right. And that's what you mean for post-Simpson reality not being an illusion. On the impact,
right?
It's really green.
Not just the vessel is green. The light, the light is green. Now, that's already a bigger chiddush. You could say Hashem created a vessel. The vessel is green. The water hasn't changed a thing. But we don't see the water. We see the water only through the vessel. And for us, it's green. But Chassidus says more than that. The light assumes the green color. What would that mean in the Tzimtzum? That the light, from the perspective of the recipient, is really condensed. Which means that the Tzimtzum is a reality in a way for Hashem also, as He impacts us. You get what I'm saying? I didn't want to get into it, but that's already a little bit of a deeper step.
So in other words, what you're saying is the pre-Tzimtzum reality, we have no concept of any words we have of it. It's ineffable, to quote Rabbi Arikapel. Well,
in the Tanya, the pre-Tzimtzum reality in chapter 48 is Atzilus.
Right.
It's not even and even that's infinite. And even that's infinite, and if it would be expressed, mm-hmm. we couldn't be finite.
Right.
So that's what our model is here.
I presume if it was if we would experience Aptik Yoimin of Oilam Asiya, we would be swallowed up.
Yeah.
You know, if we, you know.
But there's a difference. There's a difference when you talk about an infinite source that creates the world, like here. We talk about an infinite source that transcends even being a source for creation. When you talk about an infinite source that creates the world, like Hashem's knowledge, you're swallowed up in that source, but you can find yourself in that source. When you talk about an infinite source that transcends even being a source for creation, like Hashem's essential energy, you can't find yourself there. You have to lose yourself there. So it's a difference between how you get burnt here and how you get burnt up here.
It's the degrees.
It's not just the degrees. It's if there's a you there. Dr. Rebbe teaches in Lekudei Torah Tazria, they're serving Hashem al menas l'kabel pras, and shaloy al menas l'kabel pras. So literally, you say either to get a pras as a reward, pras.
Prize, probably is related to it.
From pras, prize. Pras literally means a piece, like prusa, yachatz. There's the shlema, there's the prusa, the piece of the matzah that's broken. We call a pras. So literally, you say either to receive a piece, a prize, or not. Alter Rebbe says deeper. Al menas l'kabel pras is you don't serve Hashem for reward. You serve Hashem because you want to be absorbed in godliness. But what are you looking for? You're looking for a piece of godliness, which means you're looking for how the divine energy condensed itself in a fashion where it's only a piece, so to speak, of its original identity.
User-friendly.
And you're looking for that. Why are you looking for that? Because you're ready to be absorbed there, but you'll be able to appreciate that, because that's godliness, that's user-friendly. It's not user-friendly in an egocentric world, but it's user-friendly in a spiritual world. Amanasha le'el akabah process. You're not interested in a piece of godliness, you're interested in Hashem himself. But if you're interested in Hashem himself, over there, there's no you anymore. He says, that's Aveda.
but the people who reach that don't exist anymore.
They don't exist separate.
One moment. No, wait. Wouldn't their very bodies burn up if they really were there?
No.
Am I asking this sincerely, just following the way the
L'chaira. L'chaira. What do you want us to ask? Why is a stone less chilek alakam mal mamash than an asham? Two things, two differences. Let's use the model of chapter 2, it'll be easier, then we'll bring it back here. He said in chapter 2, what's an asham? Man de nafach mitaychi nafach, vayipar ba'apav nishmaschayim, Hashem blows. Blows his breath into Adam Arishan, and that creates a neshama. Yeah. Versus speech. It's not speech, he calls it, it's a thought of Hashem, not a word of Hashem. No. Also, but more than that. What's the difference? One difference between breath and speech, we know. Breath comes from a deeper place. If you blow for a long time, you get exhausted. You can speak for hours and not get exhausted. Some people, at least. That's one difference. But there's a deeper difference. The deeper difference is when you say Hashem blew a neshama into the nostrils, what's the neshama? The neshama is his breath, that is the neshama. He blows his breath into the nostrils, and that breath in the nostrils is the neshama. When you say Hashem created the world through speech, it's not that the speech is the creation. The speech creates the creation. It's an important thing. That's a big difference. And that's, again, why the dream is an incomplete metaphor. Because the mental images we create in our mind, I'm not a neurologist, but they are the very stuff of the brain waves. When you say Hashem creates a stone, the definition of its creation is that he thinks about it, true, but he creates a stone. A neshama is not that. A neshama is his energy becomes the neshama. In other words, a stone is part of the world, and the soul is part of the creator.
To order additional MP3 CDs, call Heichal Menachem at 718-633-1076 or visit us at www.chassidus.com. That is chassidus.com.